The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
In the context of your novel, what is a tilt shoot?
A tilt shoot is a device used in the old cowboy movies to simulate, well, not simulate, it actually causes a horse to fall off a cliff. Horses won't voluntarily, of course, jump off a cliff, but often in those old movies, they wanted to show either a hero escaping the bad guys or a bad guy escaping the heroes by jumping off a high place into a river or a lake. So because a horse won't do it on its own, they would create a big platform that tilted, and they would grease the platform and then lead the blindfolded horse onto that platform. The stunt rider would mount up, they would pull off the blindfold, and then the grips would tilt the chute so that the horse slid down the greased chute and off the edge of the cliff. And then they would edit that piece of film so that it would look like the horse had galloped right up to the edge and then jumped.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Molly Gloss about her novel Falling from Horses, which focuses on Hollywood in the year 1938. In your novel, the protagonist is Bud Frazier, and when he's 19 years old, he makes a decision. Tell us, who is Bud, and what did he decide to do?
Bud is the son of Martha and Henry Frazier, who were characters in an earlier novel of mine, The Hearts of Horses. There's been a family tragedy, and Bud's been sort of on his own for a year, year and a half, and just sort of bumming around, working odd jobs and riding rodeo. He decides to hop on a Greyhound bus and go to Hollywood to work as a stunt rider in the cowboy movies.
And during that bus trip, he meets a woman named Lily. Tell us about her.
Lily is a few years older than Bud. She's a Seattleite, a college graduate who's been working as a newspaper writer in Seattle, and she's going to Hollywood as well with notions of becoming a screenwriter and ambitions to be a director and producer of film. She wants to be famous, as it were, and to both write and direct films.
Lily eventually became a writer in the story, and she was an intellectual who ultimately got into trouble with McCarthy. Did you base Lily's character on an actual person?
There were several women writers in Hollywood who got into trouble with the McCarthy hearings in later years, who had some sort of connection to the Communist Party or who were singled out by other people in Hollywood for that, sort of fingered by them. So there was no one particular one, just a general knowledge that several women were caught in that web.
Your descriptions of the behind-the-scenes filmmaking are really detailed and vivid. It seems like a lot of research went into this story.
A lot of that was hard for me to ferret out. The information about the stunt riding I could get at, but what was difficult for me was finding the details of the actual filmmaking. There's lots and lots of information about the sort of, I don't know, the upper echelons of Hollywood, but not so much about the nitty-gritty of how a film is made. And I was never able to actually observe a film being made. So I would ask myself questions like, okay, where is the director standing while this shot is being made? And, you know, when do they call in the stunt director? And where are the cameras? And what does a camera look like in 1938? Those kinds of things were hard for me to dig out. I did eventually dig them all out, mostly by a long research trip to Los Angeles. There are a couple of wonderful places there, the Margaret Herrick Library, which is run by the same people who put on the Oscars, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. They also run the Margaret Herrick Library, which is not a lending library. You have to go in and look at the work right there. But they have a huge archive, and I was able to find a lot of information there about, you know, photographs in particular, which were very, very helpful to me for imagining what that was like.
You've listed several books in the acknowledgments section that look really fascinating.
One I used, relied on quite heavily for the stunt writing aspects, is a book called Hollywood Posse, which was written by the daughter of one of those anonymous stunt writers from the early days, who was part of that world for many, many years. Her dad was in the movies as an anonymous stunt writer from the early silent days right up into the 1950s. And she wrote a very useful memoir about that world. And there was a useful book about women who were in the Hollywood business back then called Script Girls, so that I could imagine Lily Shaw based on some of those women.
Let's go back to Bud. When he was a young boy, he was living on his parents' ranch in Oregon, and nothing about that life was easy. And I'd just like you to read a few paragraphs from your novel that explain what he had to go through just to go to school.
Sure. Some ranch and farm women living in remote parts of the county moved to town in the winter when their kids were in high school, but Martha never did. She still had horses to care for and Henry relying on her for help with the cattle. The high school in Burns was 20 miles by road from the Eckel Ranch. A school bus came out from town to pick up the farm and ranch kids at Foy, where they waited out of the weather in a building that had been part of the old rock quarry offices. But Henry or Martha had to drive their son from the ranch to the highway junction every morning on winter roads and make the trip again in the afternoon to bring him home. Even in dry weather, getting up and down between the ranch and the bus stop, 16 miles round trip, could take an hour or better. In some places, they had to gear down and take it slow, the truck's thin tires bouncing heavily and the ridge between the ruts sometimes scraping the axle. If the truck hit something hard enough to mash the oil pan, they had to stop and crawl under, take off the pan and beat out the dents with a hammer, put it back on, add fresh oil. In spring, when the parkland flooded the road, they had to drive wide, veering off through the trees and the willow brush, and even then sometimes the truck mired down and they had to walk the rest of the way home and bring back the mules, hook a chain to the axle, and haul the rig out by brute force. For Bud, the ride to Foy was only half the trip, as the bus made 6 or 7 stops on the 12 miles of gravel highway between the quarry and the school. He left home in the dark and got home in the dark. And there were quite a few times that year when the snow was too deep to make it out to the highway. When he stayed back at the ranch, Martha, who was dead set on making sure her children got an education, pestered him to read aloud to her in the evenings from one of his school books. And she asked Henry, who kept the accounting ledgers for the ranch, to pose arithmetic problems that Bud had to solve in his head, a pointless exercise since Bud had already moved on to algebra. By midway through that first winter, she had begun to fret over the number of days her son had missed school, and she and Henry both were pretty fed up with the long drive taxiing their son to and from the bus stop. So the next year, they sent Bud over to Hart, 80 miles away, where there was a public boarding school that drew students from the far corners of Harney County and Malheur County. The students lived in a dormitory building next door to the school, boys upstairs, girls downstairs. The dormitory was shut from Friday noon until Sunday evening, as most of the ranch kids went home for the weekend. So the handful of students who lived too far away to make it home were housed around town with the families of local students. Bud spent the weekends with a family named Dickerson, whose son Dean was in Bud's grade. Bud went home only in the summers and at Christmas and for spring roundup.
It seems like the isolated life that Bud and his younger sister lived was so extreme, as that passage just illustrated, I mean, no wonder they really liked to watch movies. They really got excited about going to see a movie.
They did, but you know, I don't think they thought of it as such an extreme or isolated life. They, for them, it was nothing to ride, let's say, an hour to get to the movie theater, to ride horseback, to get to the movie theater and meet their friends there and just turn their horses out in the vacant lot next door. I mean, this was how they lived their life. It seemed ordinary to them, I think.
Mm-hmm. Even though Bud did notice that some of the activities that he saw in the movies were just heroics. I mean, nobody was out there forking hay or doing all the mundane chores that he did on the ranch.
That's right. In a way, the movies were appealing to him because they weren't like his own life. He saw from the beginning that the so-called ranch life in the movies was not at all like the ranch life he knew. But that's what kind of what made it appealing to him.
As an adult, Bud noted that, quote, "It's always been rare for any Western to spend more than a minute or two counting the cost of what it means to be a hero." Do you think that's still true in the movies?
I think in Western film in particular, there has been a movement toward that. I think a film like Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven is trying to dig away at that a little bit to show what that really means in terms of the violence that is often the lot of a hero, what that means for the hero in his life. So I think there has been a little bit of a movement in that direction. I think there's still a long way to go. And certainly in many films that I think of as the heirs to the Western hero, films about, you know, modern renegade detectives and things like that, that there's still so much focus on their heroism, their courage. There's very little room in that for, as I said, counting the cost of being a hero.
Was there a moment in particular when you just felt compelled to write the story?
Well, I've been sort of digging down into the Western mythology through many of my novels, most of my writing career, digging down deeper and deeper into it. And I think it was probably inevitable that I would eventually get to the movies because while the Western mythology has shaped our American culture, the Western mythology itself has been shaped by those films from the 1930s and 40s. So if I'm going to explore that Western mythology, I really eventually needed to get at the movies.
Yeah, it's interesting that, if I'm remembering correctly, the first Western was filmed in New Jersey.
Yes, and some of the most famous Western novelists never went west of the Mississippi, so there you go.
Yeah, they were all going on myths themselves and building bigger myths.
Max Brand is one of the more famous Western novelists from the early days, and his only experience of the West was riding in an air-conditioned car across the West in the 1920s.
What else do you want us to know about Bud?
Bud represents for me a person like myself who's come from a sort of romance relationship with the cowboy hero and has gradually over the years seen the seamy underbelly, the dark side of the cowboy and the cowboy mythology. And he's come to understand it. And not to demythologize it, but to find a new way to look at that cowboy myth that maybe includes the heroic things that happen in ordinary lives, the courage, the self-reliance, the things that we admire about the cowboy. But he, like me, would like all of us to give more focus to tell the cowboy that he doesn't have to be so bloody and lonesome and violent. So I think Bud is, in a way, is a representative in his life of a growth in understanding of that mythology. And in that way, he represents my own understanding of it.
His relationship with Lily went on for their lives, throughout their lives, but it was never romantic.
No, and I didn't want to tease the reader with that for very long. There is a brief period, I think, where readers might think, oh, this is going to be the woman that he becomes his wife. But I didn't want to tease you with that. So it isn't very far into the novel before you realize that, no, it's not Lily that Bud winds up with. And I wanted to portray a friendship, a genuine friendship. I have several friends who are men, and it's interesting to me that relationship and how it's different from, or can be different from, two women's friendships, two men's friendships. And in this case, I think Lily was important to Bud in many ways, in spurring him on to thinking more deeply about some of these things that he encounters.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Molly Gloss about her novel Falling from Horses. If you just tuned in, you can hear what you missed at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link on our Facebook page. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about present-day movie myths and animal cruelty. You might be surprised by how little has changed. Stay with us. You wrote this book from two points of view, first person and third person omniscient, if I'm remembering my literary definitions. Why did you choose a split voice for the novel?
Well, Bud's story always seemed to me needed to be told in Bud's own voice. So that was an easy one for me. The first sentences of the novel came easily to me, and they were always in Bud's voice. When I began to write about Bud's childhood, I wanted more freedom because I wanted to start with when Bud was quite little, when he was only a couple of years old. And I wanted to be able to explore his whole family, not just Bud. And so I chose a voice that I hope is the same voice that I used for The Hearts of Horses, that third, as you say, third-person omniscient voice, which is throughout The Hearts of Horses. And I wanted to recapture that in those scenes as a sort of continuation, in a way, of the story of Martha Lesson and Henry Fraser that I began in that earlier novel. You certainly don't need to have read the earlier novel to understand those Echo Creek sections, but I wanted to evoke some of that same feeling in those sections. And it gave me a great deal more latitude for exploring all the people in the family and the neighbors, and not just Bud.
In the prologue to Falling from Horses, Bud calls Hollywood, quote, our great myth-making machine. And as we were just talking about, it's still going on. What do you think Hollywood is churning out as a myth right now?
Well, I don't think it's very different, actually. there's been such a huge outpouring of comic book heroism in the recent years. There's still a huge amount of violence in the films as a trope that moves the story forward. So I'm not sure that it has changed a great deal. It's still quite mythical. And the myth that shapes American culture is this myth that you can solve every problem with violence. And that's still, I think, one of the primary myths of Hollywood film.
One of the things that disturbs me about the animated films in particular, and films like The Hunger Games, is now that the women are becoming those heroic people who solve things with violence.
Yes, it's not that women are bringing their own sensibility to the story. It's that they're being given the guns and the swords.
Right. Yeah, they're imitating the men now.
Mm-hmm. There are exceptions, of course, but in general, that's what's happening.
There's another short passage I'd like you to read, which is written in Bud's voice, and this is after he's been there for a while in Southern California, and he's found work in the movies.
At the time this happened, I was making the movie that got Steve Dietz killed. When I met him, Steve had been riding in pictures half his life. He already had bad knees and had torn loose the moorings in his shoulder, which was a nuisance. His arm would fall out of its socket at any excuse. He got so he could pop it back into place, but it happened over and over. One of his specialties was being dragged by a horse, and if his shoulder went out while he was being dragged, he had a hard time reaching the release catch for the wire that went down his trouser leg onto the stirrup. I'm not sure how much of this to get into. This isn't a primer on stunt riding, but I can't really tell you what happened without talking first about the way things were in those days, men and horses both disposable. Being dragged by a horse in particular was a good way to get killed or crippled. There wasn't a lot of protection, just a close-fitting jacket, and if you bounced around, you could wind up too close to the horse and get your head kicked in. If the horse veered past the pickup men and dragged you onto ground that hadn't been prepped, you might get run into a stump or a rock, and sometimes the release would hang up. But the gag paid quite a bit, which is why Steve went on doing it, even after he wrecked his shoulder. In those days, skill was less important than nerve, but he had a lot of both. When we were kids, Mary Claudine and I used to practice the mounts we saw in the movies, leapfrogging over the horse's rump into the saddle, or swinging onto a horse that was already in motion, not using the stirrup. I think I was 12 or 13 when I broke my wrist doing one of those Pony Express mounts. And we caught hell for it, both of us, because our playing around made my folks shorthanded for the spring branding. Steve Dietz laughed when I told him about breaking my wrist. He had broken his, rehearsing one of his showy flying mounts. And he'd cracked a couple of vertebrae doing a second story mount, which is jumping down onto a saddled horse from an upper porch or a staircase. I had tried that one, too, jumping off the roof of our woodshed with Mary Claudine standing below me holding the unsuspecting horse by the headstall. I jammed my spine so hard I was just about paralyzed for a couple of days, and when the horse bolted, he tossed me and Mary Claudine to the ground. We told our dad I'd been hurt when a bull took after me in the pasture. The other thing Steve was known for was riding a horse off a tilt chute into a lake or river 30, 40 feet below. Just about any horse will balk at going off a cliff, so the grips would build a wooden chute at the brink of the bluff on top of a low seesaw platform and grease the floor of the chute to make it slick. The rider would lead a blindfolded horse onto the chute, and once he was mounted, he'd take off the blindfold and signal the grips, and when the platform tipped forward, the horse would just slide off into space. They'd edit the film afterward, so it seemed as if he'd galloped right up to the brink and sailed off gracefully into the water below. The tilt chute was a risky fall for the rider. Steve had wrecked his shoulder the first time doing that stunt, and it was a notorious horse killer. If the horse hit the water on his back or neck, he'd just roll over once and drown. So no famous horse ever did the stunt. It was always some unlucky stable horse with similar markings doubling for the star. Even if the stunt horse died, the camera would pick up the real actor swimming to shore on his famous horse like nothing had happened.
We've all seen the message at the end of a movie these days that states no animals were harmed in the making of this film. What do you know about current protections of animals?
Well, I know a little bit. I know that that statement comes from the Hollywood connection to the American Humane Society. So it means that a Humane Society representative was on set and monitoring any animal action to guarantee that no animals were hurt. What it doesn't say is that this only applies to the American Humane Society. So if films are made overseas, anywhere out of the United States, that statement will only cover the parts of the film that were made in the United States. So, for instance, a film like The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings, which were filmed in New Zealand and Australia, many animals did die in making those films, and they still had the disclaimer at the end because the parts of it that were made in the United States were governed by the American Humane Society. So it's kind of an opaque statement that you can't take quite at face value. The other thing to know is that these things are all voluntary. There's no law protecting the animals in filmmaking. Hollywood connected itself to the Humane Society in this way to prevent such, in the hope of preventing such laws from being passed. They saw the handwriting on the wall, as it were, and decided to sort of self-govern to keep the momentum from causing a law to be passed. So it's still all entirely voluntary. And if a filmmaker decides to sort of defy the Hollywood machine, he or she can still make a movie in which animals are harmed or killed, and he just wouldn't have the disclaimer at the end.
It just seems incredible that this is still going on.
Well, I think that some of the worst abuses have stopped. Even the animals that were harmed in the making of The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings, those were not deliberate harms. It's not as it's described in my novel, you know, a case where they know a horse is going to be killed and still they run them off a cliff. It's not like that. It's more a matter of, there's so many horses and we put them all in a corral and we forgot to assign someone to bring water to them. And so they die of thirst. I mean, it's kind of negligence and stupidity rather than deliberate malice or deliberate disinterest in the well-being of the horses or the animals. So I think there has been progress made everywhere, really, at least in the developed world. But there's still a ways to go. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because today, driving over here to the studio, I heard a piece on the radio about the animals in the labs, in the testing labs for getting pork, for example, to be less fatty, getting steaks to be more tender, the ways in which the test animals are abused to get those results. So there's still a lot of animal cruelty out there, that's for sure.
Molly Gloss lives in Portland, Oregon. You can listen to this program again and find more information about her and her novel, Falling from Horses, at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Links to that information are also on our Facebook page. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.